Hello and welcome to another Social Dad podcast. Today I'm talking to John Baker, CEO of D2L, who recently did a study into how parents are feeling about school openings and the education of their kids throughout and beyond the whole pandemic. Hi, John.
Hi, James. It's a pleasure to join you today.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. Could you briefly explain what D2L is?
So D2L is a company that built a learning platform to support schools, universities, and companies all over the world. And I started in my third year of university to transform the way the world learns. I was wrestling with one key question: what's the most important problem that I could solve that would have the biggest impact on the world? And I couldn't think of anything bigger than transforming the way the world learns, because learning has this wonderful ripple effect from one person to the next, from one generation to the next, through our communities, through our companies, and through our countries. And I believe learning is this foundation upon which we make progress. So D2L set out to build a learning platform that would delight clients, but really importantly, break down barriers that get in the way of high-quality learning experiences, and to hopefully engage and inspire people to achieve more than they ever dreamed possible. So it's been a couple decades of this, but really pleased to be joining you here today.
Thanks. So your survey found that of Canadian, it was just in Canada, right?
That's correct. Yeah.
Okay. So 36% of the parents surveyed are feeling connected, 29% are feeling overwhelmed, and 20% of them feel empowered by online learning platforms as part of their child's education experience. Why was this survey held, and what did you expect to find out?
So we know this is a stressful time. We did a survey in the fall, just as sort of a benchmark to help understand, you know, how parents are doing. It's really important for us to, as you know, folks that are working in the education space, to really understand the engagement with parents and families and guardians to really help drive success for learners. And we wanted to gather insights about how parents feel about the school year so far and what we expect the school year to be ahead. And to really understand how the use of technology might have either a positive or negative impact, and what we can do to make the experience better, to help reduce anxiety, help to provide a clearer path forward into the future. But it was good to see that parents were feeling connected through technology, but it was also surprising at the same time that there's so much anxiety and uncertainty. We didn't expect there to be nearly 50% of the parents surveyed to feel that, you know, feel highly anxious and uncertain about the future.
Yeah, I mean, as a parent, I think a lot of the anxiety comes from I feel responsible more than just doing normal homework and things, but for my child's education. So if I am now the person who will be making sure that she's sitting at the computer, she's paying attention, she's learning whatever, whereas before it was nice that you could, or it depends where you are in the country, but right now we're in BC, so my daughter's gone back to school, and it's really nice being able to hand her off to the teacher, and you know that she's in good hands. She's going to be taken care of, her questions will be answered, they have learning plans, all that kind of stuff. But when she, if she has to learn at home, that responsibility is now on me. And I know as a parent, it's all ultimately down to me and my wife. But you know what I mean? Like, it increases the anxiety, not just around the whole COVID and the whole everything else and all the trying to balance work and personal time, whatever. But now I've got to figure out if my child is paying attention in school, which is now at home.
Well, it's hard. I think parents that are not used to their kids being home learning, it's a challenge, especially if you're working and trying to support your kids in getting the education they need. I know this too myself, you know, James. I've got three young daughters, mm-hmm. two of which are supposed to be in school on a regular day. They're just back to school today, actually, for the first time in several weeks. And one that's busy learning nonstop. She's only two, so she's always at home. But it's not easy for parents to sort of manage all of these things all at once. And frankly, the way that we responded during the pandemic where we required students to do things all real time using synchronous technology, for example, video or what's called remote learning. Mm-hmm. That's hard. It's hard for the parents. It's hard for the teachers. It's hard for the students.
I mean, as like kids love to, you know, play games, watch cartoons and stuff on the screens, but as soon as it comes to actually having to sort of participate and wait their turn, when there's a class of other people all trying to get their teacher's attention, it quickly falls apart. I mean, my daughter, she missed it. Was, I mean, she was in kindergarten at the time when we first locked down in, I don't know, March 2020, but she was used to being able to, you know, if you ask enough times, you get the teacher's attention, but she couldn't do that because she was muted, which is wonderful for the teacher. But like my daughter was just, she was losing attention real quick. And I think if that was to happen again, I don't know how well she'd do, unless it became a sort of, I don't know, a bit more in back and forth, sort of interactive.
Yeah.
Well, I think your class.
Yeah, that's not easy. I agree. And if you look at the research around some of this technology, you've got about 2 hours in the day where you can hold a kid's attention using technology like Zoom or some of these other remote learning technologies. And so you have to be a very creative teacher. And we definitely saw that demonstrated with a lot of teachers out there in the world using this type of technology to support that learning experience. That said, you know, if we have more time to put in place a more purposeful, planful experience for students, we can make that learning experience at home more engaging, more inspiring, help them through the experience in a much better way. And the model that we've seen with virtual schools over the course of the last 20 plus years is a much better way to do that flip back and forth between at home or online. And so there was not time for all the different school districts to pivot to that richer online learning experience for at home. It was we were kind of forced into this remote learning, which wasn't the best experience for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, I think we all pivoted very, very quickly, more sort of successfully than I think we all feared that it would happen. Even with working remotely, when for years middle management would say, no way, you can't work from home, doesn't work, you need to be in-house to go to meetings. And then as soon as we had to, oh, surprise, surprise, it actually works fine. In fact, we're more productive. Yeah, I've been saying that for years. What do you think is helping the parents who feel connected versus the ones who don't? So do you think the people who worry that they're not connected or they're anxious, do you think they have less tools available to them? Like they don't have a spare computer, they don't have someone to sit with them and make sure that the kids are sitting at the computer and actually concentrating, they're not just playing on the phone or look, you know, on Messenger or something.
Well, I think it's a number of factors. One of the keys to feeling better connected is the communication that's occurring. Is there good feedback? Is there good communication with the teachers? Is there a good quick assessment of how your kids are doing? And getting that feedback real time for the parents is really important to make sure that they're on the right track for success. At the end of the day, you want to make sure your kids are staying on track or potentially even getting ahead based upon, you know, what they're supposed to be learning. You know, we saw different ways of doing that in terms of giving good feedback or helping to share assessments of how kids are doing. A great example would be, you know, there's a concept of a portfolio where students themselves can capture and share learning experiences. We saw those things being used in classrooms where, you know, your child would capture and share a learning moment that's happening in the class, and then they would be able to share that back with their parents at home so that you sort of get a window into the classroom. But when we pivoted to the pandemic, we had to flip that model so that you as a student at home would be able to capture and share experiences that you're having in your house, whether it's a little video of you doing a project or a picture of you doing the new lesson on electricity, for example, or robotics, whatever it might be. And then you can share your own learning and in your own voice back to the teacher. It gives, you know, that little bit of feedback, that little bit of insight into the learning experience, and it helps assess whether, you know, your child's on the right path for success or not. Being able to make tweaks like that to pivot from the window having to be into the classroom to the window being into the house actually makes a big difference for feeling connected, for feeling like you're getting the right feedback to help make sure that your child's on the right path. Yeah.
It's not uncommon for teachers, especially those in lower income areas, to have to pay for their own class supplies, you know, pens and notebooks and things. If the kids are expected to have tablets, computers in their homes, how do you think they'll cope?
Well, it's hard. And I think the way that we're approaching it today is even harder, because you technically have to have a device for every kid if we're doing it synchronously.
Yeah.
And so that puts a burden on parents to have all these different devices, plus high-speed bandwidth to do the remote learning that we're doing today. I think there is a better way. You know, for example, when we built our technology, we built it so it supported what's called responsive design. So you didn't have to have the latest iPhone or iPad or Android device. You could use any device that had a browser attached to it. And then other models of learning were, you know, again, going back to the virtual school model, where students don't have to be all online learning at the exact same time, allows kids to share devices in the house and to do activities when they're inspired to do them versus having to do them or waiting their turn. And so there are different models to help reach students that are probably the most at risk in the community. But we're definitely seeing the impact on students that are in these homes where they don't have internet connectivity, or they don't have the latest devices, or they don't have broadband, being negatively impacted. We're seeing that in the results with the surveys with the parents. I also participated with the Industry Strategy Council in Canada as we looked at trying to figure out how to navigate this pandemic and how to work on getting the economy back on the right track and potentially even reimagining the economy for the future. And one of the big areas that got a lot of support and across every sector of the economy was support for making sure that we had better broadband access in our homes. So everything from, you know, fiber optics to low Earth orbit satellites to any other way of getting access and connectivity out to everybody universally, that was very well supported. And we're just now starting to see the changes that are going to be required, but this will take years for us to roll out to every household. It's just going to take some time.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, there's been a global need for internet for, you know, general use, working from home, education, whatever, especially those people in more rural areas, in countries where they don't have ready internet access, for people who have to walk for an awful long time to get to a school, or would only go like once a week because they have to work and they're, you know, kids in that kind of impoverished situation. But I think the pandemic has really kicked things into gear where even private companies like Elon Musk's satellite things, where countries, you know, India, China, Africa, everywhere, even like in the States and in Canada, where they're not connected to things as readily as we are in the city, we have to have connectivity. Otherwise, we're going to have a huge sort of generational dip of people, for kids who didn't have access to the education that they needed. And then that has a ripple effect with industry and salaries and living quality and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, I could agree with you more. It was a state visit that I did with the Governor General to India that really opened my eyes to this over 5 years ago. We visited one of the poorest communities in the country, arguably one of the poorest communities in the world. Mm-hmm. And I remember sitting, it was a girls' school in one of the slums. And And I remember sitting with these girls, and they were showing us what they were learning. They were learning how to sew and learning Excel 95 skills for data entry. And one of the girls put up her hand and said, you know, when are we going to be taught something that is going to help us in getting out of our circumstances? And I was, you know, quite taken aback. It was, you know, a really bold question. And I remember the governor general's wife, Her Excellency, stood up and showed them how to do some exercises because, you know, healthy living was really important. And all of the girls took out their, you know, their devices and took a picture. And of course, I asked, well, how do you all afford, you know, phones? And well, they said, you know, these are third hand, fourth hand phones. They don't cost very much. And we use Wi-Fi for connectivity. And it was an aha moment. If we can, you know, reach them on a browser, which we can pretty much reach almost everybody today using a browser, even in war-torn countries, even if it's just periodically, there's no reason why we can't reach them with the best learning experiences in the world. We can break down these barriers. And it's a design problem. It's not necessarily a technology problem today. We can do better in terms of getting more broadband, higher quality experiences out to more people. But we can also design our technology today to reach every learner. There's no reason not to.
That's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I think also, I mean, the curriculum is out of date now as well. I mean, people need to learn more about, you know, side hustles and how to do your own taxes and stuff. And it's like, we didn't do that. Wish I did, because I've got no clue how to do it. Luckily, my wife is very good at that kind of thing, because that's what would be having, you know, people knocking on the door. I don't know. It'd be interesting to see how, like, what kind of skills do you think kids would need to deal with the world now versus when the curriculum sort of was last changed, whenever that was?
Oh, I think curriculum has to be a living document. What we're trying to learn to prepare students for the future is going to be very different than what it was 20 years ago. There's a lot of things that we were learning 20 years ago that are still relevant. But if you think about it, we also need to spend a lot more time on what I would think of as durable skills, communication, entrepreneurship, collaboration, critical thinking, leadership. All of these are very durable. It doesn't matter what the times will be. These 21st century skills, if you will, are really relevant today to help provide our kids today the education they're going to need. You know, specific technical skills, you know, we change programming languages in terms of how to build our technology every 5 or 6 years. And so those will come and go. But the underlying understanding of how to actually program or the key concepts, these are all very relevant. Artificial intelligence, gaming, these things will be very important in terms of curriculum in the near future for a lot of regions around the world. I could talk about that for a long time, James.
It's fascinating.
Yeah, but I think we have a bigger challenge right now. If you look around the world, we have what I'm referring to as sort of a lost generation emerging, where hundreds of millions of kids globally have fallen out of the school system because of this pandemic.
Yeah.
So if you leave, you know, let's say, for example, you have a kid in grade three and they've left in grade three, and 3 or 4 years later, they look to go back to school. They're not going to want to go back to grade three. They're going to want to, you know, be with their fellow classmates. And so we need to think about new ways of providing a better way to learn all the basics, if you will, of what we're learning today in a more efficient way, so that these students can catch back up with their classmates and then hopefully reach ahead and achieve more. And there are new models of learning. Many of our thought leading clients are already starting to embrace this concept of what we think of as mastery-based learning that can provide a pathway for these students to get back and engaged and get back on the right track for success. But it requires a lot of change. You know, we've got to be ready for that.
And there'll be a huge gap in the sort of not just aptitude, but skills and the sort of learned abilities. If the kids are dropping out of the school system for a year, 2, 3 years, and then they're coming back and then they're going into, I don't know, grade six, for example, and they wouldn't have had this sort of structured learning. There's a lot of the sort of unwritten social learning that you get when you're you know, playing in the playground and you're having conflict and resolution and learning how to deal with other people and finding what makes other kids tick and how you interact with them to either escalate or de-escalate any sort of situation. And it's those sorts of things I think will be lost if children are not in a school setting.
I don't think you need to. Well, by the way, I think both my parents are educators, so I've got
mine
no
too.
Issue with what's happening in the school system. I really do think the use of technology to support a classroom experience is by far an incredibly good experience for kids, mm-hmm. and for all the reasons you just cited. I think a lot of these students that are dropping out maybe in grade 3 and trying to rejoin in grade 6 or grade 7, I don't think they're going to miss out on the social side of things. You know, their development, their problem solving, their ability to navigate is probably going to be heightened. I think it's only the, you know, unless they're not engaging with the broader community, if they're, you know, in their house, not going to school, that's going to be where there's going to be a real challenge.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, if you think about remote or kids flipping to sort of the full virtual experience instead of going to school, there are still ways for them to pick up all of those social, emotional learning experiences, if you will, through other types of engagements. They can still play sports. They can still engage in community activities. They can still do a lot of these other different efforts, if you will. But, yeah. But I don't think it needs to be one or the other. I think you can blend these worlds together. So one day you're doing virtual and the next day you're back in the classroom. I think that's
an idea. Yeah, I mean, I think that the sort of social side of things, it depends on what's available in their areas. I mean, I know... I've been to sort of a lot of busy cities, like in the States and things. And I know that there's a lot of areas where they don't have community sports. It's just too dangerous to hang around in like a basketball court. So they don't. They go home, they watch TV. The parents are at work because they have to be. And they can't afford, you know, iPads and laptops and computer. They don't have a computer in the house. So do you think there's going to be a larger divide? I mean, I'm thinking sort of longer term, a larger divide between the haves and have-nots when it comes to educational tools and the quality of at-home learning when the kids aren't in school.
Yes. I think we've been set back probably 2 decades in the education system if you look at what's happened in the last 2 years. Again, hundreds of millions of students have dropped out entirely. I think many of them are getting an experience like you just described. And we've got to do more. We've got to do things differently to get them back and re-engaged because they're not going to want to pick back up in grade 3 if they left at that grade level. We need to, you know, my mom at one point taught in a one-room schoolhouse for grades 1 through 8. You can do this. We can figure out ways to leverage technology, adaptive learning, mastery-based models of learning to help these kids catch back up faster, but yet still stay with their age range, if you will, for social development and for other forms of growth. We can address these, but it requires us to be ready to make a change because we just can't fail the students, which is a mechanism being used in some jurisdictions today where you just hold the student back as they come back into the system. That's not a great strategy. We can do better, but it requires us to get out of this emergency response frame of mindset and get into a bit more of a strategy on how to actually implement a solution that's going to address these problems head on. Because if not, even last year, a year ago in January, the World Bank was predicting this is a $10 trillion problem in this generation's lost earnings potential. Yeah. It's not a small problem. It's a big one.
Yeah. I mean, how do you recover from that? you hire the older people and then you just hope that the next generation is going to make up the difference before the old people all die.
Well, you see different strategies being explored, right? You're seeing some jurisdictions just holding students back. So that'll work for some. So if they didn't achieve what they need to progress forward in their education, they could just get held back a grade or two or three. You're seeing others take more radical approaches to the challenge of lowering standards, where you know what we expect of kids as they get progress from one grade to the next, they're actually lowering the expectations so that there is still progression. I don't think either of those are great answers. I think
no, we can you can't sort of say, ah, well, you know, we were hoping for a, I don't know, a B grade, but if you get a D or you write your name right, that's good enough, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Come on in. I don't think we want that. We need to put in place a little bit more thinking around the strategy around this. And again, I think largely, you know, there's a lot of problems that governments are facing right now, and this may not be at the top of the pile, if you will, for the emergencies they're going through, but it should be, because we're sacrificing the future for our kids. And we need to put more energy into this, because there are solutions to this problem. I just, you know, the one example that I gave where we have all the content for all the grade levels, we can create adaptive learning pathways and mastery-based models of learning to help personalize the education for each kid, meet them where they're at today. These models of learning, you know, you can learn about twice as fast as you could in a traditional method, if you will. And so you can catch back up much faster. And really importantly, you stay with your peers, if you will, at your own age level. Even if you're behind academically, we can catch you back up there and get you back on track.
And then just sort of thinking about their lost earning potentials, like during the pandemic, which is such a tired phrase, I think we're all sick of it, but like at the beginning of things, a lot of sort of not younger generations, I don't know, 20s to 30s were moving back in with their parents just because they either couldn't work and couldn't afford rent. So they went into their parents' house, back into their old rooms, and either paid them rent or just sort of lived free. But if that generation who... they're not going to earn as much as they would have because they've missed out on a few years of training or work in their industry. Do you think there's going to be an impact on their parents' generation who, like, I'm hoping my daughter's going to be a doctor so I can have a cushy retirement. But if they're missing out on a few years of education and then they're not earning as much as they could have had they been on the normal path to college and going, you know, up the ranks of whatever job they went into, and then they help out their parents when it's their time to retire, because generally speaking, pensions don't give you that much. Do you think there's going to be a knock-on effect to the older generations?
I don't know how there isn't. You can't have a $10 trillion ripple effect without it impacting older generations. So what will that mean? Yeah. It means if we don't have them entering the workforce when they need to, or them doing the work that we all hopefully aspire to, that means many of us will still be here working longer than we expected. It'll delay retirement. It'll do a whole bunch of other ripple effects, if you will. But you can't wipe out $10 trillion in earnings without it having a knock-on effect. Just like both of us talked about learning having a ripple effect for better or for worse. Mm-hmm. And the key now is this is a problem. we've got to address it.
Yeah.
And we can't just sweep this under the rug. This is not how learning occurs. It doesn't bounce back like the economy races back. We need to invest to support the learning growth now that we've seen learning losses.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's a problem that sometimes it's easy to think, oh, well, you know, what do kids learn when they're five anyway? Not much. Bit of ABCs, some basic math. But as soon as you start to think, oh, actually, this is going to affect me in my retirement if my kid isn't learning as much as they should do, in the early years or whenever, like however old the kids are, then I think you're going to get more investment from other companies and other like governments.
There's a bit of an enlightened self-interest.
Yeah. This is my problem.
This is my problem as well.
We should fix it quick.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, that said, I am also incredibly stunned. We've done lots of surveys over the course of the last 2 years of teachers and seeing what teachers are doing. I've been very impressed with how resilient the education system has been and how resilient our students have been and teachers. But there are problems here, specifically for a lot of, millions of kids that have not benefited from some of that good education, good experience with the teachers.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's amazing if you have a good teacher who cares about the kids and who has access to the tools and is savvy enough to be able to use Teams or whatever they're doing, you know, and a school system that has access to software that they can then give out to the students. But as soon as there's a teacher who isn't that bothered, like it's a paycheck, or the school system just isn't there to support them, then you've got real issues. Just to wrap up, from the survey, so it looks like over half the parents felt positive about their child's progress so far. Was there any data about how the kids felt?
So we have not surveyed the students themselves directly. It's just been the parents. That might be a good idea for the future surveys. I would just have to rely heavily on, you know, listening to parents in this regard. But I think kids are struggling. I don't know about yours, but my kids really wanted to get back to school. But when the day came, they didn't want to go.
Yeah.
You know, I think they're struggling with all these different mandates as well. And so we're not quite sure what the ripple effect will be for kids long term here. We're nervous about it, just like the survey is showing us as parents. But at the same time, you know, as we hopefully have a little bit more time to be a bit more planful in the months ahead, we can start addressing this and turn this into a learning growth opportunity and not focus so much on the losses that we've incurred.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's so different from household to household, how the children, how the parents were able to sort of pivot what they were doing. I mean, in ours, we were lucky that either my wife or I was able to stay home and work from home or just be with our daughter and play and try our best to entertain her or trying to think up sort of little lesson plans. And also that the BC government didn't want to delay too much getting back to schools, because it's you're either going to get COVID or not, but they're just sort of, you know, making everyone wear masks and doing what they can. But they need to be in school. And I think the BC government at least saw that it's super important for them to be there as much as possible. But how that plays out later, who knows? I mean, there's Omicron now. There could be, I don't know what's after that.
Omicron. Yeah. I think, you know, the one piece of data that I saw from the, and it was very prevalent in BC, it was actually way above the national average, was, you know, in terms of what can educators and schools do to help families overcome the challenges in the months ahead, and that's offer additional support where it's needed. I think parents are looking for even more support than they've gotten so far, at least from the data that I'm seeing. About 49% of parents in BC in particular are looking for that additional support where it's needed. And I think it's telling. I think it says that, you know, as much as we've all rolled up our sleeves and worked incredibly hard to make sure the education system is as resilient as possible, there's still more work to be done to support the educators, the schools, and the families to help make sure their kids are as set up for success as possible.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, sort of for me, it feels a bit more like we're all in it together rather than, you know, dropping off the kids, see you at 3 o'clock kind of thing. It's sort of reminding me of how involved, I mean, I'm this is my only child, so I've not had to experience this before, but finding out exactly how much I need to be involved in their education. But even more so now, because sometimes I have to be the teacher. Which I enjoy, but I'm glad I'm not doing it all the time, because it's hard and I wouldn't want to do it with, you know, 20 kids.
So I think we've all learned to appreciate our teachers. we really appreciate them.
Yeah, that National Teachers Day, they're getting, you know, a bit more than an apple this year. John, yeah, thank you very much for doing this. This was fantastic. So where can people find the full results of the survey and the tools that you offer?
So in terms of the survey, just check out our website, d2l.com. We have a little section for our newsroom, and then get a little bit more detail on the survey there. And then d12.com is also a good spot to learn a little bit more about what we're doing. And in BC, we're just actually doing a big rollout of our technology across BC right now as we speak. So I'm very excited, and hopefully we do a lot more. And we have an office in downtown Vancouver. So maybe, James, the next time I'm doing the podcast, I'm hopeful that'll be face to face. So thanks for your time here today.
Thank you. Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.